The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The youngest we met was 10 years old. We spoke to them. It was very unclear, as I say, why they were there. Because when the battlefield was cleared, of course, some people went to camps and some people went to prisons. No one appears to know why. And they were certainly in a state of distress. One of them asked us privately if we could help them be moved to a child-only cell. There were rumors at the time that there was sexual violence against the young boys. Subsequently, that did happen. The boys in the North Wing, the miners who are in the North Wing where the standoff have been moved there, kind of out of sight from the media, precisely because there was an outcry after this that there were kids in the general population. But yeah, as I say, it's a pretty desolate place and one where you really feel that the world has turned its back.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 28th, 2022. Late last week and early this week saw fighting between Islamic State fighters and Syrian Democratic Forces after the Islamic State attempted a jailbreak of a Kurdish prison containing significant numbers of alleged Islamic State fighters. The makeshift jail housed Syrians, Iraqis, but also alleged fighters from Western Europe and North Africa. It's the most significant jailbreak since ISIS territorial defeat and a major national security story that's gone under the radar. To talk it all through, to think about the scale of the damage and all the things that led to us getting to this point, I talked with Leah West, Assistant Professor of International Affairs at Carleton University, and Louisa Lovelock, the Baghdad Bureau Chief at the Washington Post. We broke down what's happened so far and what to make of it all. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 28th, an Islamic State jailbreak. All right, so Leah, before we get into what happened this past week, let's talk a bit about this prison. So what is the prison? Where is it? And give us sort of a vague sense of who's in it and in normal times, who controls it, right? So we'll get into the specifics of all this as we go along, but just in the way of background.
So we're talking about the Sinai prison, which is located in the Gueren district of Helsinki City, which is a large city in northeastern Syria. So it's often referred to as Gueren Prison or Helsinki for that reason. It's basically the old campus of a university, and the buildings have been used as a makeshift prison essentially since the fall of Baghouz in March 2018. So they started housing combatants that they were taking off the battlefield as people were surrendering or being captured, and using this old university to house prisoners. The estimates are that it's housed between 3,000 and 5,000 people at various times, you know, mostly ISIS-linked prisoners, but there are also young boys being housed there. So those that were old enough that they didn't, that the SDF made the decision, so the Syrian Defense Forces, they didn't want to house them in the camps with mothers, but not so old that they, you know, they are children. So there's a mix of men and boys. And these are makeshift prisons, so you have to think of it as, you know, large kind of classrooms or rooms where people are living in rooms of 20 to 40 people, mostly living, sleeping on the ground, etc. It's not what we think of when we think about a regular prison.
All right, so Louisa, with that in mind, could you walk us through everything that's happened last week? So there's been a lot, and there's been a lot of small details, and I think we're still sort of figuring out some of the stuff, but just give us a rough TikTok of how things have evolved over the course of the past week.
So this attack started, we think, late Thursday or in the very early hours of Friday morning with a car bomb, we think, on the western side of the prison, which, as Leo says, is, you know, it's a school and a makeshift prison. It was never meant to be a secure facility. When the car bomb went off, as has happened on several previous occasions, the prisoners inside, the guards say, they effectively started to riot. They thought that people were coming to rescue them. Some of them may have thought that members of the Islamic State had come as promised to rescue them. And the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, say that their staff were overpowered. Some of them were killed. It looks like some of their phones were taken, and those phones were subsequently used to get messages and films out of the prison by the prisoners. Now, the standoff that ensued as the SDF went in lasted for 6 days. And for the most part, I have to say, it has taken place in something of a media blackout. We've been reliant on the US-backed SDF, who are doing the fighting for news, and it has been difficult to cross-check things. So some of our understandings might change, but what we do understand is that in the final days, this basically was a standoff in the Northern Wing. And the Northern Wing is where these miners are. As Leo says, you've had these miners in this prison for almost 3 years now. I went there in 2019. I met a bunch of them. And it's very unclear, to be honest, why a lot of them are there. Some of them have come from the camps and have come, you know, after the age of 12, they've been separated from their mothers. But others were just picked up in Baghouz right at the end of the operations. And it's not clear what the SDF thought they were doing, but this is where they were. So they ended up sort of at the center of this siege, where the SDF will say that the alleged ISIS militants, and I should say alleged because we don't know who's in there, were sort of holed up in that place. And there was something of a firefight. Grenades were thrown. Snipers were used all around to try and kill the militants. And then day by day, they negotiated the end of a standoff. And as of now, this is Wednesday evening, Iraq and Syria time, it looks like that standoff has ended. But the damage is certainly very unclear. We've seen early photographs which suggest there is pretty extensive damage to parts of the prison, suggest it might not be used again. But we don't know the death toll. We don't know how many people have escaped. And yeah, a lot is very unclear.
And over the course of the past week, were there moments where it seemed like this was going to end particularly poorly, right? So as of recording, we're recording Wednesday, late morning, Eastern time, it seems like the SDF has taken back control of the prison. But were there moments over the course of the past week where that seemed like that might not be the end result?
Absolutely. And even now that we're hearing from the SDF that it's over, we're hearing from other people that we should wait and we should see what happened. Because when you have a negotiated standoff that has been as nasty as it has been around miners, you know, around people who effectively sound like they became human shields, I think there was great concern that this just might go completely wrong and a lot more people might be killed. You know, the SDF are a US partner force. The US-led coalition will praise their capabilities routinely. But a lot of them are still not particularly well-trained. They're certainly not trained for a hostage situation. And I think that, you know, you say, was there a moment or were there moments? There were many moments, and they were probably coming 6, 7, 12 times a day.
And so do we have any sense of how many people actually made it out of the prison, right? So I would assume that, among other things, the objective of the prison break was literally to, you know, liberate ISIS detainees from captivity.
Right. I mean, SDF officials are saying that there are probably the people who have escaped are in the low dozens. But of course, if they've got out, they might have got to the local neighborhood, and combing operations are certainly going on in the houses. So it's not clear of those dozens of people how many, for example, have been recaptured, how many have been killed. I think this is one of these things that really isn't going to come out until the dust settles. But I think a really good point that Leah makes is that, you know, she said there are between 3,000 and 5,000 people in this prison. That is an incredibly ambiguous range of numbers, and there is very little transparency around who is in there. So when the final headcount comes, you know, it's possible to question if they'll really know how many people are gone.
And Leah had mentioned too that the prison, it's not just a prison isolated in the middle of nowhere. It's a prison within the, you know, the broader confines of a city. Do we have a any idea of how much the fighting sort of spilled out into the city and affected people living in the area surrounding the prison?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly spilled out into the surrounding neighborhoods. The sort of the three adjacent neighborhoods appear to have had clashes in them. The SDF secured a security perimeter relatively early and appears to have evacuated people from their houses during that time. So, you know, we haven't had much visibility on what's been going on purely because, you know, they've really tried to lock it down. But from what they say, clashes have been ongoing. And as of tonight, even though they say the prison is back under control, it sounds like there's still low-level fighting in one of the adjacent neighborhoods, at least.
All right. So I want to back up a little bit here and think about this in a broader lens. So, Leah, did this feel like an exceptional event to you? Like, how rare is something like this? I know there's been some instability in the prison and in other SDF prisons over the course of the past couple of years, but this felt different, right? And give us a sense of why that is.
Yes and no. If we want to go really broad context, terrorist organizations breaking their people out of prisons is, you know, pretty par for the course. But in terms of northeastern Syria, we've actually seen kind of increased efforts to break men out of these prisons. So there have been incidents inside the prison dating back to March 2020, where prisoners inside the prison were using makeshift weapons to you know, take security officers hostage and creating a lot of damage. There's been several instances of that in 2020. And then over the course of 2021, we heard from kind of internal counterterrorism forces inside Syria that they were thwarting plans from outside groups, so people outside the prison, ISIS sleeper cells, etc., who were planning to coordinate attacks and escape attempts on the prison. Even as recently as December of 2021, we were hearing that there were raids and that, you know, the chief planner of an attack had been captured. So, you know, it started with the internal riots. Obviously, when you have thousands of people in a makeshift style prison, and who knows how many actual internal security folks, and you're dealing with environments that were not designed to be prisons, you know, lots of instability inside. But now we're seeing more and more attempts to break people out and finally, you know, a successful attack. But we've also seen attacks on the camps and breakouts in the camps. And here I'm talking about Al-Hol in particular. We've seen rioting in the camps as well. And you know, there was one camp, not Al-Hol, a smaller one further west, where there was a massive breakout back in 2019, late 2019, I want to say. It could be early 2020. None of this is really all that surprising. This is just seems to have been the best coordinated, most successful, and therefore most violent attack yet, and obviously the most sustained level of violence between those inside the prison, ISIS supporters or fighters outside the prison, and the SDF.
That's helpful, Leah. But I wonder, too, if we could go back a bit and just give us sort of the Cliff Notes version of how we even got to the place where the SDF is detaining, you know, alleged ISIS fighters in a former school with, you know, limited security, people crammed in a room. Give us a tiny bit of sort of the long-winded arc of how it came to be that the SDF had custody of these people and that it was the SDF alone, basically, who's responsible for their security.
Yeah, so the SDF is a coalition of militias, essentially, that were partners with the United States in fighting ISIS very successfully. So when ISIS was losing territory, as I mentioned earlier, and they were, you know, basically streaming out of Baghouz at the end of in March of 2018, they were being taken into custody. This was being done by both American forces who were on the ground and the Kurdish forces as well, and being placed into either detention camps. So if they were women and children, essentially, they would be being placed in camps. And, you know, fighting age males were essentially being put into prisons. And as we talked about, men under 12 also seem to be separated out and put into the prisons as well. And so basically, all of those who were in northeastern Syria supporting ISIS, be it their family members, children, or fighters, were largely rounded up and placed into makeshift detention centers or makeshift camps. And so now we have one massive camp of women and children. I think the numbers now is about 65,000. It had swollen to over 70,000 at one point, about half of whom are children. The majority of women and children in those camps are actually either Syrians or Iraqis, but about 15% are those who came from elsewhere across the world. And then again, the prisons hold those fighters, again, largely Syrian and Iraqi males. But again, we do have Western and European and fighters from North Africa and the Caucasus, et cetera. And so as they got rounded up and put into these detention facilities, and we decided that ISIS had been defeated and the U.S. Withdrew forces, the SDF were ultimately left holding the bag. And that bag was about 70,000 ISIS supporters and fighters. And they've had some support from the international community, obviously from human rights organizations as well, who are working in these camps. But essentially, it's been left to the Kurds, who, I should add, lost over 10,000 people in the fighting against ISIS. The Kurds, who were the victims of ISIS control and violence, to ultimately care for, house, feed, and to an extent protect, to the extent that they can, these ISIS supporters, family members, and fighters for the last 3 years.
And Louisa, you mentioned that you had been to the prison, I think you said in 2019, right? Could you talk a bit about like what you saw when you were there and even just a sense of what the sort of demographics of the prison felt like back then?
So we went, as you say, in 2019, kind of during the Turkish invasion of northeast Syria. And it's really an experience, I think, that stays with me. You really start to get a sense of the scale when you see the CCTV, the CCTV rooms that the guards operate. And you see bank after bank of cameras showing the cells. The men and the boys are in these bright orange jumpsuits, very reminiscent of Guantanamo, and then in turn reminiscent of the same types of jumpsuits that ISIS copied for their execution videos. Now the alleged ISIS members are wearing them again in these prisons. The overcrowding was, at that point, I would say extreme. I understand that it has diminished somewhat in the intervening period, but people were packed so tightly that often they were draping limbs across each other. People who sort of got up and tried to totter across the room to get a plastic bag or whatever, they hang their possessions on the wall. You'd see them sort of wobble and almost fall sometimes. And that's an illustration of how packed it was. In the prison ward, which is downstairs, which is effectively a sort of a dormitory wing, people were still clearly very, very wounded. It was about 6 months after the end of the battle for Baghouz, and people had lost limbs. In place of their limbs, they had metal pins. We saw people who did not appear to be in particularly good mental health. There were some incredibly distressed people in there. But really, the most shocking thing we saw was the kids. You know, when you walk into this dormitory, what they've done to sort of keep it quote unquote safe is you walk into a bit of a cage, and in front of you is the dormitory, but there are bars between you and the men. And myself and my photographer Alice Martins were scanning the room, and suddenly one by one we were seeing children. The youngest we met was 10 years old. We spoke to them. It was very unclear, as I say, why they were there. Because when the battlefield was cleared, of course, some people went to camps and some people went to prisons. No one appears to know why. And they were certainly in a state of distress. One of them asked us privately if we could help them be moved to a child-only cell. There were rumors at the time that there was sexual violence against the young boys. Subsequently, that did happen. The boys in the north wing, the minors who are in the north wing where the standoff have been moved there, kind of out of sight from the media, precisely because there was an outcry after this that there were kids in the general population. But yeah, as I say, it's a pretty desolate place and one where you really feel that the world has turned its back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I didn't visit the prison, but I visited the camps in 2019. And the feeling I had when I left is that ISIS is not defeated. They're just being held back behind these very flimsy and makeshift security perimeters. And, you know, until we've actually addressed that fact, ISIS lives, breathes, survives in these people and in these either camps or prisons.
Yeah. And to that point, I'll open this up to either of you. So, Louisa, you were there in 2019. At that point, was there any sort of vision as to what might be the end game for the people detained in the prison, right? Like, I know there have been a series of different plans, most of which have completely collapsed about, you know, judicial process for these people or, you know, attempts to send them back to their home country. What was, in 2019, what was sort of the vision of what might happen to the people that I gather have just more or less ended up staying there?
If I'm honest, I don't think there was an end game then, and I don't think there's an end game now. You know, the population has certainly diminished because the Iraqis and other governments have been slowly taking their people back. But for a lot of governments, they've just left their people there. And the process to even find out how or why or how many is incredibly untransparent. Governments tend to be more preoccupied with domestic concerns, right? With seeming strong on security. And being strong on security and through that framework, through that lens, is not bringing these guys back. And I don't see that a huge amount has changed. I've been asking in recent days in Iraq, where I live, you know, whether this is likely to accelerate the transfers of Iraqi detainees, for example, because, you know, Iraq shares a border with Syria. It's clearer than ever that these prisons are not secured. A lot of the people, some of the people we saw in the videos of escapees were Iraqi. And, you know, we've been saying to the officials here, is there a plan? What are you going to do? But the problem is that in the one country that has taken a large number of people from the region, or one of the main countries to take a large number of people, they have no capacity because they themselves are also dealing with legacy prisoners from the Islamic State. They're also dealing with foreigners in their prisons, and there's no space.
So Leah, this is maybe, I don't know, the third or fourth time that we've talked on the Lawfare podcast about this very issue, but Louisa gave a helpful sense of how Iraq has been dealing with this. Give us a sense of sort of the non-action on behalf of European countries and the scale of the problem to the extent that we know of European foreign fighters detained in these camps and prisons.
Yeah, so I just say at the beginning, we did see a number of states like Kosovo and Kazakhstan make large efforts to repatriate significant numbers of their population. And then since then, the lack of action or the focus has really been on the fact that Western nations, Western European countries, the United States, Canada in particular, have not made any real efforts to repatriate the women, children, or men. The United States, I will say, has made significant efforts to repatriate, to prosecute all those that they want to prosecute, including some from other states. So they've repatriated, well, that's not even the right word. They've essentially brought Canadians and UK citizens to the United States to face prosecution in the US courts for their crimes with ISIS. But we're not seeing significant efforts by any other country, Western country, to do that. When we do see repatriations, they tend to be small numbers, ones and twos of children, mostly orphaned children in particular. And we have seen states really push back against legal challenges that assert that states have any obligation to repatriate their citizens who are in these camps. And I don't see that changing. There is no political appetite for this at all domestically, and very little to be gained domestically from doing so, even though we know that there are thousands and thousands of children living in either prisons or in camps in conditions that do not withstand scrutiny under humanitarian conditions. You know, the SDF and the AANES, you know, basically said, we're doing the best we can, but they don't claim to be able to meet the standards needed, you know, for humanitarian conditions. And they are consistently asking the international community, not just to repatriate, but if you're not going to repatriate, you know, help us provide safety, security, nutrition, healthcare. You know, we are still going through a global pandemic that hasn't, you know, changed. And we're dealing with people in really squalid conditions here. We're very, very lucky that given the transmission of COVID, it hasn't had huge outbreaks in these camps, but that was certainly a worry at the beginning. But the administration in Syria, northeastern Syria, has basically been left on their own to deal with this, despite the fact that, you know, we relied on them to defeat this threat that we accepted was an existential threat to global security. But once, you know, they were safely behind bars, we walked away.
If I might just add, you know, I speak to a lot of people from European countries, from North America, who will say, you know, these citizens chose to go to Syria. They chose to go to Iraq. Why should we bring them back? You know, they turned their backs on us. They're not our problem anymore. And I think what that often overlooks is the long-term Western role on getting these countries to this situation in the first place. Because, of course, the 2003 US-led invasion of Iraq, for example, was a sort of a very important moment in the destabilization of this part of the region. It led to the rise of precursor organizations to ISIS. And the forces that now pick up the pieces from the rise and fall of ISIS are the same forces operating with this heavily weakened capacity, the same states operating within the conditions that have developed in the 19 years since 2003. They often lack capabilities. They are often very corrupt. Often they're not really kitted out for the type of fighting that they're meant to be doing. And, you know, we look at why are ISIS somewhat resurging in Syria. It is precisely because the forces are not really capable, or they only have a military solution to what to do. They are unable to deal with the same socioeconomic conditions that led to the group's rise in the first place. And it's going to happen again. And I think that when we look at these countries and we say, why should we take them back? We should take them back, I would argue, because our governments were partially responsible for how we got into this mess in the first place.
And Leah, on top of that, could you talk a bit about, you've both sort of alluded to this at different points, what's the security risk of failing to repatriate or just sort of letting the SDF be responsible for what seems at this point like indefinite detention of large amounts of ISIS fighters?
I think the obvious one is that the next time a prison break of this nature is more successful or leads to catastrophic loss of life. And that would be a huge, huge victory for ISIS. It would certainly put them back on the map. I can't imagine the propaganda and, you know, a victory of that nature would give to the movement who, you know, continues to try and recruit. I can tell you here in Canada, we just had to issue 2 terrorism peace bonds to young people because of alleged association with ISIS. ISIS continues to have a draw across the world. So that would be a huge propaganda victory for ISIS should they be successful. And obviously then that creates instability, further instability in the region if you have these fighters rejoining ISIS and ISIS feeling reinvigorated, which we're already seeing in one particular region in Syria. So the other thing I will say is that this, from a human security standpoint, is that the longer that these people languish inside these poor, squalid camps, the more likely that we're going to see people, you know, with serious diseases, malnutrition, mental illness. You're basically condemning an entire generation of children. We're talking about like 30,000 children here who have no capacity for education. They're essentially being raised to an extent by ISIS supporters, right, without really any outside kind of influence at all. And the conditions, as like it's been 3 years, they're not getting better. You know, so disease, mental illness, lack of capacity, really, you know, you're condemning these children to having no options at a future either. So long-term security issues are there, even if ISIS isn't successful.
You know, I think that another part of this picture, of course, comes with people who maybe are from Syria or are from Iraq, who have been in these camps, have been in these prisons, but have subsequently left. They've been allowed back into their local communities, and what happens next? A lot of the people that we have met who have been able to come home in some way, shape, or form, you know, they're back in their houses. They're not being attacked by the communities around them, who suffered vastly at the hands of the group that these people allegedly joined, or at least who they lived with for a time. But they're not being welcomed either. You know, people say that they would not invite these people over for a meal. They would not let their children play with them. And over the long term, dynamics like this, and schisms that happened far beyond before this, but dynamics which persist, are leading to long-term social divisions. Again, the likes of which the SDF do not appear, and their partner self-administration do not appear to have the capacity to solve. And while these divisions fester, you know, even if they don't lead in the long term to the ISIS 3.0 that you will hear about a lot, they will lead to significant civilian harm. They will lead to people being ostracized to the point that they don't have access to basic services. They will be ostracized to the point where maybe kids don't feel they can go to school, have an education, people can't get jobs. And in the long term, from the perspective of civilian harm, that really isn't good.
Do we know, Louisa, in the context of the immediate attempt to quell what had happened last week, how much were Western countries involved in getting things back down to a level of relative stability, right? So there's this sort of abandonment on the level of detention policy, but has there been a sort of corresponding effort to remediate the immediate problem at hand?
So from what we understand, the US-led coalition was pretty instrumental to the extent that it was launching quite a lot of airstrikes, both in the prison complex and outside the perimeter. They also had ground forces helping secure the perimeter at a certain point. So, you know, they were there. They were there with boots on the ground. They were there with bombs in the air. And that is something that they've shown up to do time and time again when it comes to the fight against ISIS. But, you know, it's not clear what else they're going to offer, you know. It's not clear what training they're going to offer the SDF. It's not clear, you know, how they're going to help the SDF start to patch the holes which are leading to this increase in attacks. You know, if you look at why ISIS in Syria specifically is in the position it's in, it's because actually, you know, this is a country that is controlled by multiple forces. It's of course ruled by the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, but it also has this enclave where the Kurdish-led authorities operate. And while the SDF and the coalition were somewhat successful in pushing ISIS out of there a couple of years ago, and they pushed them into central Syria, government-held Syria, once the government effort got a bit more successful, ISIS sort of basically just came right back and came into the northeast. And during that time, because the SDF has not really been very successful at healing these social divisions and sort of trying to cultivate the intelligence networks that it would need, it's come back to an area that is far more fertile for them to be able to conduct the sort of operations that they have. And that is a big question that the coalition and international community will need to help with. And I don't see that they have an answer to it.
So I want to wrap up by asking you both the same two-part question. So on the one hand, do you anticipate what's happened over the past week actually changing anything? And on the other hand, if you had your druthers and you could really, you know, have an impact on long-term policy toward detention in northeastern Syria and toward defense policy in northeastern Syria, what would you hope that the real takeaway would be and the sort of inflection point might be as a result of this? Louisa, we can start with you.
I don't think that anything has significantly changed as a result of this prison attack, because I think that this prison attack was a symptom of where ISIS are rather than a sign that they are changing. But if I were a policymaker, you know, I would want the attention right now to be on bringing my nationals home, particularly the children, and trying to identify where the partner forces and the partner governments can be helped in sort of starting to heal these severe societal divisions, trying to create a better economic environment, social environment, and political environment. And of course, as international policymakers, that's always going to be hard because these are sovereign countries, and often the ways in which foreign governments engage with these host governments actually exacerbates the problem. So I suppose I would ask them to take a step back and, or if I were them, I would want to take a step back and think, how can we really help?
And Leah?
So I'd like to think that policymakers, and I'm thinking especially in the Canadian context, will look at this and say, those children that are in these camps and prisons that are our citizens are at real risk. And that should reaffirm the level of risk to them and be a change in circumstance that refocuses the efforts on bringing them into safety and security. However, I suspect that governments will instead use this as an example of why Syria is an unstable region and they can't possibly send their folks, their consular people, their mission staff into the region in order to assist or pull them out. That has been the excuse, I know from Canada's point of view especially, that it's simply too dangerous for us to go there to do anything about this problem. And unfortunately, I think that this will, instead of showing why we need to take the safety and security of these victims, these child victims, even more seriously, it'll just be a way for them to double down on their excuses not to do anything. Bigger picture policy-wise, you know, I'd like to think that this would lead the United States to maybe increase their support and presence once again in the region and bring some coalition partners along with them. But given all of the political dynamics and what else is going on around the world, again, I'm not optimistic. I was speaking with a friend about this issue earlier, and their response to this was not, "Now, ISIS, I'm tired." And I think that really does capture the sentiment, is that there's just so much else going on in the world that seems to pose a more direct consequence for those of us in the West, that I am not optimistic that we're really going to see anything happen as a result of this. And I think we'll look back and say, once again, I told you so.
And on that cheerful note, we are going to have to leave it there. Leah and Louisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for talking about this.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo for her audio engineering. And as always, to our producer and editor, Jen Patia Howell. Your music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan. And please do consider sharing us on whatever social media app you choose. As always, thanks so much for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.